Here's Howie with Howard Sexton.
The notorious Howard Sexton. How are you doing, Howie?
Apparently, here's Howie.
Do you approve of this thing, Howie?
I'll have to take it under consideration. I'm not entirely clear.
I like it. I think it's got a bit of a vibe to it. Now, talking of the notorious Howard Sexton, we want to talk today about the notorious RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And, just reflect on her life a little bit and the legacy that she left behind.
So, of course, the first thing is where the name comes from. So there was a rapper called the Notorious B.I.G.
Right.
And a New York law student actually decided that that would be a great reference because Ruth Bader Ginsburg was known as RBG. And a New York law student thought it would be really applicable to take this octogenarian and call her the Notorious RBG because of the trailblazing efforts that she had for women's rights in the United States, and she loved the name, and the name just stuck.
It is kind of interesting if you think about it, Howie, because you don't think about judges, of all people, are kind of having cult celebrity status. But, you know, if you go to New York, sort of in the more hipster areas, her face is on T-shirts and bags. They wrote a book about her with this title, etc. So it is quite an interesting thing that she was became so famous later in life, and someone, you know, could actually identify an octogenarian, as you say, judge as being a hipster symbol.
You know, she is a pop celebrity, and that's the best way to really describe her. And she said at age 85, she was at a conference, and she said, "I'm 85 years old, and I'm a judge, and people want to take selfies with me. I don't understand." But there's this amazing thing that seems to have happened with her death, and she seems to have been embraced by so many, and she seems to represent so many of the values that we've traditionally associated, particularly with being Jewish. Kind of the centralist liberal, the academic, the embracing of life, this worldview, this whole concept of what Judaism used to stand for, she is really a symbolism of all of that. And she grew up in an era where the things which today we take for granted related to women's rights just weren't even a standard right at the time. You know, when she arrived at Harvard University to study law, there were only 9 women in her class at Harvard. And the dean of the faculty of law invited them over for dinner, and he had a question for them. And the question is, why are you studying law at Harvard? You're taking the place of men who should be here instead. And that was one of the reasons behind her deciding to actually leave Harvard. Her husband, Marty, had moved to New York, and she finally graduated top of her class at Columbia Law School. But this concept that why are women taking men's places studying? They shouldn't actually be at university. You know, today we take that as such for granted that, of course, women are going to go to university. Of course, they're going to become lawyers. But when she graduated, she couldn't get a job. You have the top student at Columbia Law School graduating, unable to get a job in New York because law firms did not want to hire a woman. And she said she had 3 strikes against her when she graduated. The first one was she was Jewish because still many of the law firms in New York wouldn't employ Jews. The second was because she was a woman. And the third was at the time she had a 4-year-old child and no one would employ her. And in fact, to try and get a job, she wanted to become a clerk at the Supreme Court. The justices of the Supreme Court refused to hire a woman. Her professors actually went and threatened judges that they would stop providing candidates to judges as clerks unless they took Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
It's really, really a remarkable life from that perspective. She also had some very interesting idiosyncrasies of her own, Howard. I heard a story once, you know, she was very famous for wearing these lace silk collars wherever she went. And apparently they each symbolized something different. So as a judge, she didn't really speak out too much on political affairs or anything like that. But when she felt like there was something she disapproved of, she actually had a collar that she would wear that symbolized in public her disapproval without actually ever saying something, which I think is quite a clever way of handling that particular problem.
So she was often in the minority on decisions. She was known as a dissenting judge. And one of her great views was, you dissent today, but this is the way you in fact change laws and you change people's opinions. And when she would give a dissenting judgment, she would often wear a gold embroidered necklace or bib almost round her neck. And it was symbolic of the fact that she was going to dissent. But the entire concept of this lace that she wore round her neck was actually very interesting. So when she was appointed to the Supreme Court, she was only the second woman ever to be a judge of the Supreme Court. The first was Sandra Day O'Connor. And the two women on the Supreme Court realized that the black gowns, the robes that the judges wore, were in fact meant and designed only for men. And they had a cut in the front because they needed to show the fact that the men were wearing white shirts, which they always did, and a tie. And our women, of course, were not going to wear white shirts and a tie. And so she and Sandra Day O'Connor got them to redesign the judge's robe. And they wanted something very feminine to put in. So they created this concept of the lace that went around the neck. And she had an entire selection of laces that she would wear. And in fact, one of the laces that she owned was given to her by Kim Lieberman, the South African Jewish artist, who designed this beautiful lace for her to wear in court. And in fact, Judge L.B. Sachs, on one of his trips through to Washington, D.C., delivered for Kim this lace to the notorious RBG.
Now, what's also great is that there is a lot of popular culture around her. She had, as I said, a book, but also a documentary and quite a good movie actually about her as well. So she'll be inspiring for next generation as well.
So, you know, she was a trailblazer, and things like books and documentaries just document your life. They don't create the history that goes behind it. But even before she became a judge, she fought every major case for women's rights before the United States Supreme Court. And that's an amazing thing to do. And it ranged from everything. It ranged for example, the rights of spouses to be able to get access to husbands' pensions after they pass away. She fought a case in American law. There's something called the Equal Protection Clause, that everyone is equally protected under the law. But who is this everyone? She fought the case that said everyone includes women. It's such a basic concept. But you must understand, this comes from a different era where people never ever thought that these things as equal protection would apply to black people, would apply to women. It was written and conceived that the people it was protecting would be that all men would be protected rather than all people. And that was one of her great things. She wrote the brief. The case is called Reed versus Reed. And it's a very famous United States Supreme Court case. But that's, in fact, where it comes from. So she arrives at court with all of these things. And she says when she graduated law school, there wasn't a single judge who was woman on the entire U.S. Circuit Court system, in the federal court system. Not a single judge. How can we today even conceive of that? So she becomes this trailblazer, and it, in fact, it's Jimmy Carter who elevates her, having seen how she's fought all of these cases for women's rights, and Jimmy Carter becomes president in 1980, and I mean, not long ago, that's 40 years ago, and Jimmy Carter, in fact, says, well, we have to start changing what the bench looks like. We need women judges. We need judges of color. We need Latinos on the court. And he appoints Ruth Bader Ginsburg to first the District Court of Columbia, the Federal District Court of Columbia. And then when Bill Clinton comes on, Bill Clinton, in fact, elevates her onto the Supreme Court. And she becomes the first Jewish woman on the Supreme Court. And in fact, her body is lying in state at the moment. The first time any Jew has lain in state at the U.S. Supreme Court, and the first time any Jewish woman has lain in state as well. But that's kind of the notorious symbolism that this woman really was.
And so it's just, I want to just do touch on, unfortunately, just the politics of her death, right? Now, you know, it's unfortunate that I was listening to some people who were examining her role, and almost the first thing they did was talk about contemporary U.S. politics as opposed to reflecting on her life, which I think is unfortunate. But it is, the timing of her death is important in the U.S. Context. So I do want to just spend a little bit of time saying what are the consequences of it happening now.
So we know one of the most hotly contested, fought over things in America is always who gets appointed to the judge, as a judge of the Supreme Court. Because the Supreme Court has so much power in influencing culture, issues of abortion, of women's rights, of equal protection, of human rights, that in fact, probably one of the most important lasting legacies of any American president is always who they appoint to the Supreme Court. Now, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was appointed, she was considered the centrist liberal. And she remained very much a centrist liberal. And the court moved to the right as we had a number of judges passing away, and many of the conservative presidents that came afterwards, whether it was George Bush, etc., got to appoint more conservative judges. And now the real question is, well, who replaces her? How conservative does the court become? Now, you may remember in the last year of Barack Obama's presidency, in fact, a vacancy opened up on the Supreme Court, and Barack Obama appoints a judge or nominates a judge. And all the Republicans say unacceptable, led in fact by Donald Trump. And they say in the last year of a presidency, there is no way you can allow a president to appoint a judge because this is a lasting legacy. So they go out and they set these principles. They call them moral rules and principles that they will not confirm a judge to the Supreme Court in the last year of any presidency. And suddenly, 6 weeks before an American election, a vacancy has opened up on the Supreme Court, which gives Donald Trump the opportunity to nominate now a new judge. And every single one of those Republicans who spoke about principles have suddenly abandoned all of their principles. Suddenly the rules no longer apply. The rules that they enforced on Barack Obama, on in fact rejecting his nomination because he was in his last year of presidency, 6 months before the end of Donald Trump's first term, those Republicans think the rules do no longer apply to him. It's such a poor and sad reflection on the American political system. The lack of values and morals within that political establishment is horrendous. Now, my personal view is, and a president is a president until the next election. A president, in my view, should be allowed to appoint a successor, no matter if they have 4 years left of office or 1 year left of office. So I'm actually supportive of the rights of Donald Trump to do that. But the problem is, these are the people who set another moral an ethical principle when Barack Obama was there, and they're refusing to live up to their own principles that they set. And that's the saddest reflection on a terribly divided American society.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. Constitution itself actually doesn't say very much about picks for the court. Basically, it says the president must choose, and then the Senate just looks at it and confirms it. And that's ended up what's happening. And of course, it was the Democrats themselves who removed one of the tools that they could have had, which is called the filibuster, which they could have used to actually stop this thing. So I do think that there are some serious, as you say, some hypocritical games that are being played around this issue. And it is unfortunate, because I do think it takes away, certainly from a proper reflection around Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But I think, Howie, that you've done an excellent job in just giving us a sense of her life. So thank you very much for that. And have a happy Heritage Day and Shana Tova.
Thank you. And in fact, tonight on our webinar with Vito, which will be at 8 o'clock tonight, one of the things we'll be doing will be paying tribute to Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the lasting legacy in the fight for women's rights that she achieved for all American women and for, I think, women around the world.
Well, there you go. Definitely looking forward to that. Howard Saxteen, the notorious Howie S. Doesn't quite work, Howie, but we tried. Joining us today to talk to us about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.